Yeah, I genuinely believe that the net impact of AI is going to be, excuse me, it's going to be hugely positive. So it definitely is going to create new jobs. It's going to make new things possible that were impossible in the past.
We're going through something absolutely historic.
Technologies across the board are growing exponentially.
It's a disruption that's going to completely redefine the way businesses compete.
In the next decade, we're going to lose 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies.
The exponential growth of computing is continuing.
AI is nowhere near its full potential.
Whether you like it or not, that the future cannot be stopped by anyone.
Hello again, everybody. This is Mark Verbenkov, and welcome to the Future Tech and Foresight podcast. This is going to be episode number 132. And once again, we're going to be focusing on artificial intelligence, of course. So as AI kind of continues to advance, one of the things that I recently became aware of, which is a critical but often overlooked aspect that comes into play, is something called AI labeling, often known as human input. So this actually is a vital cog in the machine of AI development, and we'll be diving into it a little bit deeper in today's episode. So AI labeling isn't just a technical process, though. It is actually a massively growing industry. It's worth about $5 billion US dollars today, expected to be about $15 billion by 2030, but only a fifth of its potential market is actually currently tapped, which of course leaves an expansive room for growth, innovation, and of course opportunities. So it's a field that's not also just fueling the AI revolution, but also a significant contributor to job creation in the tech world itself. And we'll be diving into that a little bit later on in today's episode. So joining me today, I'm very happy to have Ahmed Rashad, the CEO of Sapien.io, who will dive into the world of AI labeling, how it's of course fundamental to the continued growth of AI, and of course some of the challenges that the industry is facing. Ahmed will also shed some light on the cutting edge work happening over at Sapien.io and share his vision for the future of data labeling, the future of jobs, and AI in general. So I hope that you enjoyed the episode as much as I enjoyed discussing and talking with Ahmed about AI and all of these kind of wacky things that have been coming out over the last, well, several years, but most notably over the last year. Right. Hi there, Ahmed. Well, thank you very much for coming to the podcast today to talk about what seems to be kind of taking over the podcast, AI, especially over the last year, which obviously everybody's interested in. So thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Awesome. Well, as I just mentioned to you, the first question that I ask every guest is, what made you initially get interested in the work that you're doing? We're obviously going to be talking about AI today. So was there an initial spark, or was it kind of just, you know, continuous exposure to the awesomeness of AI that got you interested in the space?
I wish there was an inspiring story arc with a whole lot of twists and turns, but quite frankly, it was serendipity. It was pure luck and coincidence. I was interested, but didn't get too deep into it. I'd read about it. I'd try a few things. And then while at Amazon, I was working on a project that the obvious solution to a lot of the problems we had was AI. And that's usually how I get really interested in things. I have a problem, I try to solve it, and I find a nice tool or approach, and I get super interested, and all of a sudden, this is what I do day in, day out.
Perfect. And so how many years ago was that?
That was 2018. So yeah, 5 years ago.
5 years ago. And so like I'm obviously curious and excited about the whole AI space, but I'm a little bit on the outskirts of it. It's not my day-to-day job, right? I'm not focused on it every single day. How have you seen the AI space change? Are there any, like, obviously ChatGPT and generative AI is kind of this new buzzword that everybody's talking about. Mm-hmm. Maybe apart from that, have you seen any like really interesting innovations or changes in the last, I guess it's about 5 years now, coming on to 6 years since you've been in the space that that you'd like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually three main things that are very interesting to note. One is how early AI actually started, but the naming was different. So it wasn't called artificial intelligence, it was called a bunch of other things depending on the application. And then it started evolving, and the naming started evolving, and it started catching on. And the second thing, so of course, how early was it was there. And two is how much of our day-to-day interactions, whether at work or personally, are actually supported and enhanced and made better with AI. It's in a lot of things that we don't think about every day. So even some of the companies that you would get a loan from, they use AI to validate whether you can pay back the loan or not.
Right.
It goes in everywhere. And the third is the speed of evolution, the speed of growth of AI. It's unbelievable. And every time you think, well, where will it go next? And then you find 10 more things that it's just been going into, and each one of those things opens 10 more things, and it's just growing logarithmically, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's certainly my experience from, as I said, kind of the peripheries of this whole ecosystem. Absolutely fascinating. I think we want to maybe save that to the end. That's definitely something that we should get into, especially as the name of the podcast is, you know, Future Tech and Foresight. Yes. Right, looking to the next 5 to 10 years and what's gonna be happening. One of the things, I also have lots of conversations with people about AI, both people that are very familiar with the technology in the space and those that are not. Mm-hmm. But and I'm sure you have the same issue. One of the main topics that comes around all the time is, well, how is this going to impact work? Is it going to eliminate all jobs? Is it going to generate new jobs, like create new jobs? Is it going to, you know, modify or change jobs? Maybe just can get your quick perspective on that before we dive into kind of the meat of today's discussion.
Yeah, I genuinely believe that the net impact of AI is going to be, it's going to be hugely positive. So it definitely is going to create new jobs. It's going to make new things possible that weren't possible in the past. So think about a good analogy is the automotive industry. While we were all worried about, well, not us, but it was before my time, not at all. but people were worried, well, what's going to happen to the horse and carriage industry? What's going to happen to horses and the horse breeders and so on and so forth? And yes, it did. It probably did impact people who chose to continue in that space. It didn't impact them very positively, but it did open up a whole set of new jobs and new opportunities that weren't there before, including second and third and fourth order effect of things. Mm. So just because of the automotive industry, all of a sudden transportation became much more accessible. So all of a sudden it opened up other industries and made them reach more people. It opened up new options, whole new industries. I mean, Uber wouldn't be here if it weren't for that first part, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a very optimistic outlook when you look at it historically. Yeah.
Yes. It in aggregate, it's massively positive. Mm-hmm. Of course, there might be very small pockets that might not be positive right now, mm-hmm. or might even be negative right now. But it doesn't mean it's negative overall.
Yeah, overall. Yeah, that's I like that way of thinking about it. We'll see what happens.
We'll see.
Okay, great. So we are going to be focusing a little bit on data labeling today. Mm-hmm. So again, as somebody that's a little bit on the periphery, I'm obviously aware of it, but maybe not as much as I should be. Could you kind of give a bird's eye view of what data labeling is and why it's important specifically for AI?
Yeah, absolutely. So in general, there are different types of, you have to teach them, you have to teach AI, you have to teach the model. You have to give it a bunch of inputs, you have to teach it, you have to make it learn so that it can produce a certain output. Now, there are several ways of teaching it. Some of it's called unsupervised. Basically, the machine is basically teaching itself. You just put the parameters, and then there's semi-supervised and supervised. Mm-hmm. What that means basically is that you need some form at some level, human input into data that gets fed into the model, telling it what is what. And by the way, I generally don't like the term data labeling. I prefer to call it human input or human feedback, because it's more specific. It's actually what happens is humans are giving feedback into the model, or this type of data labeling is cool. Humans giving feedback into the model. And basically, let's say you're developing something for an autonomous vehicle. Before the vehicle can recognize that this is a person, this is a lane line, this is a traffic sign, and so on, someone needs to go in and keep telling it, this is a person, so is that. So the next time it sees something, it hasn't seen the same person before, not with the same conditions. When it sees it, it has so many examples of persons that it can say, this object that I detected is most likely a person. And that is data labeling. It applies to everything else, LLMs, text-based, vision, audio, video, whatever. It's the same concept.
Right. Yeah, I remember hearing about, I think the earliest examples that I heard about were like trying to teach AI what a cat and a dog is, right? And the distinction between those two. Sometimes it would say, well, that's a cat, but it's actually a dog, and vice versa. So I think there was like some crowdsourcing project that happened where, you know, thousands of people were saying this is a dog, this is a cat, or whatever, and it was fed into the air. And I think this is kind of what we're talking about today, or something connected to it, right?
This is exactly it. Yeah. This is perfectly it.
Okay, awesome. So I can start to picture some of the challenges or problems if data labeling is done incorrectly. And I'm sure some of the audience is thinking about that too. Could you talk to us about the problems that happens if data labeling, or human input, as you like to say, isn't done correctly?
It can be very, very problematic, because this is one of the prime examples of garbage in, garbage out. So let's say you keep consistently, and let's take this example, you keep consistently telling your model that the cat is actually not an object that moves for an autonomous vehicle. A cat's not an object that moves. It's a stationary object. The model will keep, whenever it sees a cat, it's going to assume it's a stationary object, and it's going to behave based on that. And it's going to make decisions on the car, on the driving, based on that. Now the cat moves and the model doesn't respond the way you want it to. It can be very problematic depending on the use case. In the way that's least negative, you will see the model hallucinating or giving you bad outputs, or you ask it what day it is today and it'll tell you blue or something along those lines, right? Okay. Right. So but of course, because of what we use AI in, it could have some serious negative implications.
Right.
So it needs to be done right, it needs to be done consistently, and it needs to be done in large volumes.
Right. Okay, so my next question connected to that is, as the pace of AI is, as you said at the kind of top of the show, exponential, it's just massive. I would also assume that the pace of this data labeling has to be pretty significant, if not even more, for the AI algorithms to actually learn. Is there any concern about the pace of this human input, this labeling, slowing down? And if it does slow down, does it just completely slow down the whole AI industry?
Yeah. You're spot on. I mean, it's actually what we see in the market today, in the AI industry today, that a lot of people, because of the lack of access to good, high quality, high volume, scalable data labeling, are trying to find alternatives. And they're trying to find alternatives, and it always comes back to, okay, here's an incremental improvement, but it still doesn't solve the problem, which is I need good high quality data labeling or human input into my models. It is definitely slowing a lot of people down. It is also leading to some other interesting developments, such as synthetic data models labeling the data for you, simpler other models labeling parts of the data for you, and so on and so forth. But it doesn't completely solve the problem, because the demand for data labeling is growing just as fast as the demand for AI is growing. And even if you solve a small fraction of it, you still have a huge amount, part of the problem that's just unsolved.
Right. Interesting. And are there current initiatives out there? I mean, we'll obviously be talking about your organization in a bit. but before jumping the gun, are there current, maybe not competitors, but, you know, ways or processes or like large government organizations that are trying to do this? Or is this just so dependent on the private market and the individual organizations that are building AI for this to happen?
Yeah. So unfortunately, the options that are that people have today, I think are kind of suboptimal, because you have one of three options. You can either go in and set up your own labeling operation, which is quite expensive. It's quite a hassle. You need to hire people, and guess what? You have 100 people, and your volume. You need to double the volume next week. You're not going to hire another 100 and then let it go. It's not going to work. You're just going to slow down. Plus, it's expensive, and it takes quite a bit of management overhead, and it's quite a bit of hassle. The other option is to find contractors to do it on your behalf, and this is quite difficult to do. The quality is usually not great, and it's also quite expensive. And did I say it's a pain to deal with? I should say that three times, because it's very painful. And then the third option is to go to one of the existing companies that are competent and capable of taking on volume. But these folks are facing challenges of their own, including things like scaling. And it's not easy to scale such an operation. And which actually leads me to the evolution of that the tasks themselves have gotten more and more complex. And this is why this problem is getting more and more intense. So even the existing options that you have, their feasibility is declining in a lot of ways. So it's all shrinking.
Yeah. I could imagine, and maybe you can give an example of this, right? So I don't know how many years ago, let's say 6-7 years ago, it was, you know, dog and cat. That was what the labeling problem was. Now I'm assuming it's something a little bit more complex than dog versus cat. Could you give an example to make it a little bit more tangible for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So one example actually is from autonomous vehicles. And five, 6 years ago, you needed humans to go in and label and identify and put tags on every object in a scene, including this is a person, this is a cat, this is a sidewalk, and so on and so forth. Well, now you see the autonomous vehicles actually running on the road, and they're doing well in places like San Francisco and Austin and Vegas and so on, Phoenix and so on and so forth. The problem today has evolved in a couple of ways. One, the output has become more subjective. So for example, how does this statement make you feel? Right? Or which one of these do you prefer and why?
Right.
And the other piece of complexity is just simple use cases that are inherently complex, such as one of the cases we're working on right now is detection of pancreatic cancer, which, as you can imagine, requires very, very specialized skill set. It's not a clear-cut answer in about 15% of the time. It's not a clear-cut answer. It's a whole lot of maybes and ifs, and I need more data and all of that. And also, it's a lot of data that you need to ingest collectively, identify and analyze individually, and then collectively, and then make a call. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's quite complex.
Yeah. And I can also imagine that, again, cat and dog, anybody can tell the difference. Pancreatic cancer, not everybody can tell the difference. So you need highly specialized people in order to help train or in order to give the human input.
Which actually leads to the problem of scarcity and scaling, because how can you get doctors to actually do this?
Yeah.
So it becomes a very complex problem.
Go ahead. What's the answer?
Well, there are a few answers. And the answer for us, and by the way, so we're at Sapien, we're trying to solve this problem of scalability while not increasing costs, actually, while bringing costs down quite a bit. And the way we thought about it, instead of going down the traditional approach of building a great tool and or building something that solves a specific use case, we thought, okay, we're going to do that, but we're going to do it with the lens of the human, the person actually doing the labeling, the person doing the tagging, the person providing their feedback and input. And once we started doing that, all the problems started to, the solutions to the problem started to become clearer and clearer. And it always came back to complexity. So we're solving for complexity. And the way we solve for it is we basically take any task, break it down to the most atomic level components it can be broken down to. And surprise, surprise, once you break down enough tasks, you have a library of components that later on, doesn't matter what task comes in, you just mix and match those tasks, build them up like Lego pieces, which can be automated, by the way. And you have your new task. And it really removed multiple layers of complexity that allowed us to, if there's a cat or a dog component, I can do that automatically with models. I can write code to automate large parts of it. And I don't need to send the entire thing to a doctor who understands pancreatic cancer. I can send bits and pieces of it to other people. And then I can send only the really, really difficult parts to the really, really, really skilled people. So I end up scaling up because my most scarce resources now can touch 10 analyses, 10 diagnoses in the same time it would normally take them to touch one. Hmm. Oh, and it's much cheaper too. So, kind of works out for everyone. So.
Right, right. So that definitely sounds like it's able to scale up. Is it able to scale up to the level that's needed for the amount of AI human input required nowadays because of the market moving so quickly?
Yeah, so every new use case, the way I think about it, and the short answer is yes, but the way I think about it is every use case, every complexity comes either from one of two things, either by adding components on top of it, and we already have the components, so we can just add more components on top of it. It's not a problem. It's already, you can also break it down, or a novel requirement that comes in. And for each one of those new novel requirements, like what's your opinion on this color? Then we can build a new set of modules that address this new set of components, and it just gets added to the library. So it's in a lot of ways, this is as future-proof as it gets because it's broken down to the finest components possible, the smallest components possible, and everything new is mostly going to be a combination, one or more of these combinations.
Okay, interesting. Without giving away too many secrets of your organization, could you maybe run us through an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a simplified example.
Yeah.
So from one of our wildlife customers, and this is a simplified example. So they have these trail cams set up that capture video, and they want to track motion and activity and behavior of all the wildlife that live on the preserve in the park. Mm-hmm. So for them to be able to do that, they need to identify, first part is, which we're going to focus on, they need to identify each animal and bird and creature that's there, along with the species, subspecies, age, gender, and a couple of other attributes. So the way we break it down is, okay, each one of those components, we're going to break those down. And the first component is identifying an object. So you have a scene with a deer and a bear and a couple of raccoons and a few rabbits. So the first part of it is identifying objects. That's a component. Identify objects in the scene. So if someone goes in and literally taps, here are all the objects. The second part is someone who can tell the difference between the different types of, that understands this type of, the types of creatures that exist here. And the person would go and say, deer, bear, rabbit, raccoon, bird. And now I understand that there are deer, bears, birds, raccoons, and so on. Now I can start spreading it out to people who understand each one of those creatures. And then the person can go in and say, this deer, this is whitetail, male, adult. This bear is black bear, juvenile, female, right. And so on. Right. So, and then of course there's a component, another component where you have to actually draw a box around the creature itself. But another simplification as well is we have these large scenes, but once you've identified that there's a bear in this area, you crop the image. So I don't need the whole image. So I crop the image, and all of a sudden you don't need this whole 2 gigabyte image. You need just a tiny component of it, which reduces bandwidth, which allows you to do it on mobile, which makes it way easier and way less distracting. And you don't have to do many steps. You just have to do one step. Just tap on the creatures. Okay, here's one. Find Waldo, right? Second one. Hey, here's a bear. We know this is a bear. Draw a box around it. Here, done. Right? And then it goes to someone who's like, what kind of bear is this? Black bear. Good. Next one. Male or female? How old? Right. So it's broken down, and a person could do one or more of the tasks depending on their preference and how we see them perform. So we notice trends that some people perform really, really well with repetitive tasks with some variability. So I send them, okay, what type of bear is this? And I just keep sending them bears. And every now and then I inject a few deers in just to not keep it too monotonous. And then for others, they want the diversity because that's what keeps them active. And we notice those trends. We see them from our metadata, and we see where people start doing well and start not doing well. So it's, think of it like a YouTube algorithm, how it feeds you the next videos. It's kind of the same.
That's super interesting. I think the next question here, and how do you find these people? Like, are these people that are already involved in, say, for this wilderness park, are they involved in the park already? Is there like a network that you tap into? Are there people that are just, hey, I'm curious about, you know, helping AI move forward and I'm kind of a volunteer? Because I would assume that that might be a bit of a challenge to get these people to help give this human input.
Yeah. It's quite interesting. It's actually impacted, I would think, a lot of economies in very interesting, in good ways. So this goes back to my time at Scale AI, and then advising between the time when I was advising others between Scale AI and Sapien. And during the time at Scale AI, we managed to recruit a little over 1 million people to actually do their labeling. So, and this started from a very, very small number, like a very, very small number. And we expanded operations across 72 countries. I was leading operations and growth at the time. And I just had to build those networks. I had to understand those networks. I had to understand how to go into a new country, how to set up those connections, how to find people, how to set up referrals, how to do all of those things. And frankly, since that time, we had to grow and we had to recruit people at a scale never seen before for this industry. So we know how to do it. We don't have to do it really well. And beyond that, the biggest recruiting mechanism is treat people well. Treat people fairly, treat them well. And big surprise, they start getting their friends and their family and their cousins and their neighbors and so on, because everyone's interested in this thing. People want to do good work. They just want the opportunity to do it. And if you treat people well, you pay them what they deserve, you treat them with respect, and all of a sudden they want to stay and they want to bring the other people they care about.
Right. And so
we haven't run into any problems acquiring people so far.
Right. Okay. And maybe you could touch a little bit on the payment mechanism, right? Because it's like my initial thought is, okay, this cat and dog example, I remember hearing some, like, I can't remember what it was, some NGO was using volunteers to do that. And even before that, it was, I think it was training the CAPTCHAs, right? The security CAPTCHAs on the different kind of, what is it, like bikes versus cars versus, you know, traffic lights and stuff like that. And they had some large, like, I think quite a large scale project to have people also identify those things that would then, you know, train the CAPTCHA. It sounds to me like you guys are doing something in a different way for the same sort of reason. Could you touch on the monetary aspect of that? Because I think that's also maybe interesting for maybe some people that are listening that might want to get.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way we think about it is, first of all, we pay people, right? We pay people. So that's not no volunteer work. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of things I actually want to touch on there. So the way we figure out how much we want to pay people, we actually know how long each task takes. Then we calculate that if any person gives me 40 hours of work a week, then they should be able to support a family of four. I'm not saying it's going to be great, it's going to be luxurious, but it's going to be enough to support a family of four.
Sure.
It's going to be enough to support a family of four. And you give me 40 hours, you should be able to support a family of four in the location that you're in. And we go actually to quite a high level of granularity to figure out where you are, because we can't say, for example, we can't say Kinshasa. No, Kinshasa is a big city. Where in Kinshasa? Because it matters. Supporting a family of four in different places is very different, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, if you're on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, it's very different than if you're in Brooklyn, right? It's not the same, even though it's all in New York. Mm-hmm. So we figured that out, and that's how we price how much we pay per task. Now, on top of that, there are a couple of mechanisms that help people earn more. So because we can assess quality almost on the spot, because the tasks are so simple, because we can assess quality almost on the spot, most of the time. So if we see that you're doing good work, you start earning a multiplier, and the multiplier allows you to earn even more per task. So you start earning more per task if you keep doing good work. And the idea there is, why are we fighting against our best resource? Let's just align incentives. We need good, consistent quality work. They want to do that. Let's just put the incentive so that both are aligned. And this is what we see happening. And then if someone, let's say someone is using a bot, or someone is cheating or just spamming or not doing good work, we detect that right away, and the multiplier starts going down. Mm-hmm. So there's incredible negative incentive for people to spam or cheat or do any of those things, which controls quality and ensures super high quality, which helps our customers, which brings in more work, which actually allows us to get more work to more people. And it just is a flywheel that keeps going.
Yeah. So it sounds like you've thought about this for a day or two on
about a day and a half.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Give or take.
Awesome.
I think this brings up something that has, I'll start off, the first 100 episodes of the podcast was really focused on automation, and specifically technological unemployment, and whether not just AI, but any kind of automation systems will eradicate jobs or create jobs, kind of as we started out with the top of the podcast. So what you just said really triggered a lot of the ideas that came up in the first 100 episodes. How, I'll stop talking, but how do you think the kind of future of the growth of AI specifically, with regards to what you're saying, is going to shift, mold, transform work? Are we going to be seeing more work like the work that you're describing span out across the world in order to train AI? Or is this mm-hmm. going to be kind of a one, you know, the next 5-10 years, and then, hey, all the AI has been trained, and then people can go back to doing different kind of work?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So it's a system. The relationship isn't linear, right? So let's break it apart a little bit. The bottom line is, this work, I don't think this work is not going to go away. I think it's going to continue to grow. I think it's going to continue to evolve. And let me explain why. So the first part is the tasks themselves, the work itself, even in data labeling, is getting more complex, which means it's going more towards the doctors, it's going more towards people who are more specialized, and it's moving away from, tell me if this is a dog or a cat.
Right.
What we're doing actually is we're moving the clock back. We're breaking down the tasks into smaller components. So we're actually moving away from instead of 100% needing experts, only 5-10% need experts. And then we're moving the rest of the work back to the simpler task, right? Or the simpler needs. And because the need for labeling and human input is going to continue to increase, so actually with the work that we're doing, we're allowing both ends to grow, not just one of them. Now, in the future, of course, AI is going to continue to develop, and perhaps, yes, some models will need as much human input or human feedback as they do today. Some models will evolve to the point where they can be trained by other models, and their data could be labeled by other models, and that's fine. But if history continues to repeat itself, for every model that leaves from one side of the tub, 10 more start coming out from the other side because of the things that this model enabled, or the new ideas that it sparked.
Yeah. I'm still not 100% sure whether it's creative destruction or technological unemployment. Right? Like, I think obviously history shows us it's creative destruction. There's continuous evolution of jobs, right? Transformation and new jobs coming out. Who knows what's going to happen in, I don't know, even 10 years time, 20 years time, for sure. But I think the interesting thing here, when you're speaking, is it sounds to me, let's go use the doctor example, right? They are essentially training their replacements.
Yes and no.
Okay.
So yes and no. So yes, in some cases, for some of the diagnoses, the AI can help, but it's mostly acting as a co-pilot versus a replacement. Because at the end of the day, it's at least today, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a year, maybe in 10 years, it'll change. But there is this intuition that the doctor has built over 10, 20, 30, 40 years from looking at cases over and over again, reading over and over again. There's this intuition because the science in a lot of cases, the pancreatic cancer case, for example, it's a lot of it comes down to the doctor's experience and how they perceive, how are they going to go after the treatment? What's the treatment plan going to look like? Right, it's not prescribed exactly what it is. They can assess additional factors that either are not or cannot be incorporated into the model. Right, so in cases like this, the AI evolves to become a co-pilot to help the doctor be more efficient. Now, there is an argument for this having a negative effect, because if you start using the co-pilot a little too early, you actually don't build the intuition. So where does that leave us? We're like in a little bit of a limbo here. So it's unclear to me how this is going to play out. However, for the existing system, it looks like the co-pilot is going to be something that's going to be incredibly helpful. I wonder how that's going to evolve, because again, it's a system. It's not one input, one output. It's multiple things.
Yeah, that's a fascinating idea. I haven't thought about it for a while now. Like, in my own personal experience, like, I'm using ChatGPT multiple times a day, right? I'm sure you are, and I'm sure many people out there, I know many people out there are. I consider myself a pretty good writer before ChatGPT, right? Like, I'm able to put together a university essay pretty quickly. I now see myself using ChatGPT to do those kinds of, let's just say, an essay consistently. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm starting to see it, but I'm sure if there's some like objective measure, I think that my writing skills are starting to diminish a little bit. I'm vastly more productive. I'm able to, churn out one of these essays really quickly, or blogs or articles, the things that I write. But is there going to be a point where my writing skills, if you will, decrease to such an extent that I'm maybe not even able to prompt ChatGPT well enough to churn out a quality article anymore? And I guess this is the point that I thought was interesting. If these doctors are doing more or less the same thing, obviously in something a little bit more important than just some blog or some article essay being written, is there a point where this intuition that they've built up over several decades in the career, and they're then training the AI algorithms, is that intuition going to be lost if they're using this co-pilot too much? I think this is a real question, not just for doctors and bloggers, but for almost any industry over the next, 10, 15 years, pick a date. What are your thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. I think it's, I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. It's kind of very difficult to tell. And there are a few possible outcomes, or a few possible scenarios. One is that we actually start facing a regression.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's likely, it's possible, if we don't change anything, right? If we don't change anything, we could possibly start facing a regression in many fields. The second is, and the regression is negative. The second is, we could face a regression. However, we've made enough progress. And we've evolved enough that whatever we regressed on is no longer necessary. So for example, things like tanning, for example, a tanning for leather. A lot of us don't know how to do it, right? Most of us don't know how to do it. Or how to start a fire in the wilderness. Like, we don't know how to do that either, right? Yeah.
Or a calculator, I think, is the example that comes up in my conversations all the time, right?
Or a calculator.
Yeah.
So while we retained But that's actually quite interesting, because at least the school I went to, we weren't allowed to use a calculator until I think sixth grade. Right. So you build this basic skill to understand how it works, and then you automate parts of it away, and it frees you up to do higher functions. Mm-hmm. So if you take away the, if you look at the two extremes, one is there's a complete regression and we just collapse, or two, we just evolve beyond it and it doesn't matter. And then there's something in the middle where we actually set some guardrails and discipline around education and development and so on, where you can actually make use of this copilot versus it being something that gets in your way.
Yeah.
Right. I actually faced something like that with my kids, that because they actually started in school very, very early on. They can barely write anymore. They genuinely can't write, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is where the math versus the writing thing came in, where you start relying on computers too much. I actually don't know how to write anymore, versus in math, like we still know how to do arithmetic by hand if we have to.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, this is I guess part of the bucket of questions that the general society, you know, people that are deeply immersed in the AI space are constantly talking about, and then, you know, people on the fringes get concerned because there's not a clear understanding of what's going to happen in the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. And I think it's that uncertainty that makes people afraid or concerned or, you know, ambivalent, depending on the person's perspective.
Another way I think about it is one of the best ways or one of the most sustainable ways for our economy to grow is by increasing efficiency and effectiveness, the productivity per person, and that's one of the things that creates net gain in economically overall. So I think overall, yes, the pockets, there are pockets where this might be scary. There are pockets where this might be risk, and I think we need to be cognizant of them. But overall, it's a net positive momentum that we need to keep going. Yes, we need to be careful. We need to address the pitfalls as they come along. But I think overall, I'm very, very optimistic. I think it's purely net positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really positive way of looking at it, and kind of started off that way and getting near the end of that. Do you have, I guess we've been kind of touching on it, but like, if you look to the next, I used to ask about 10 years, but I think 10 years is way too far out now. So over the next 5 years, do you have a vision? Do you have a perspective on what's going to happen? What's going to change? Like, is GPT-5 going to come out and just, you know, run rampant across the economy in a positive way or negative way? Like, what are your thoughts on the next 5 years?
Yeah, 5 years, by the way, might be too long as well. At this phase, it's not easy to tell. I think I don't know exactly what the future is going to look like. If I had to bet, I would say we would be in a multi-model future, where models are going to be competing quite aggressively for our time and attention and engagement and inputs. I think the models are going to probably, while we'll have a lot of generalized models, we'll start seeing a lot of models that are super specialized, incredibly specialized, to address specific use cases. This is a great start, what we have. But we need more specialization. We need models that are specific towards industries or specific towards doing certain types of math and so on and so forth. And I think those are already starting to pop up and will continue and continue to gain traction. And I think we will move probably to a place where the generic models are a platform. They function the same way as hardware functions today. And then all of these apps come on top of them, all of these specializations come on top of them and allow a whole lot of new things to happen and add an incredible amount of efficiency across the board. Now, where is it going to start and what's going to pick up steam first? I genuinely don't know. My bet is on the overall growth, and that's why we focus Sapien on supporting the growth of AI in general versus which sub part of it.
Right.
Because I know overall it's going to grow. I just don't know which part is going to grow the fastest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fascinating. Any final thoughts? I mean, you kind of succinctly said you're optimistic for the future of AI and how it's going to interact with the world. Are there any kind of final thoughts that you want to leave anybody interested in technology with?
Yeah, I'm incredibly optimistic. I think AI will get more and more embedded in more things that we do day to day. It's just the beginning. I think new industries will pop up. I think new jobs and professions will pop up. I think we are at this period, inflection point, where we really need to embrace change so that we don't get left behind. But I think it's beautiful and bright future.
Fascinating. Well, I think that's a perfect way to end this. Ahmed, I'll have it's sapien.io, right? The website.
Yes, that's correct.
Any other places that you would like people to follow you, get in touch with either you or the company?
Yeah, please. LinkedIn and Twitter. We're on both.
Perfect. Well, great. Thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciated it. Especially bringing me back to all those initial episodes on automation, technological unemployment, and the future of work. Good to rekindle that little fire. Thanks for coming on, and yeah, really appreciate the time.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Well, thanks for listening to this week's Future Tech and Foresight podcast. If you like what you've heard here, there are, of course, a number of ways that you can support the podcast. The best way would be to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or give a rating on Spotify, which you can find a step-by-step explanation for on the futuretechandforesight.com website. Alternatively, feel free to leave a comment either on the episode show notes or the YouTube channel where you can see video recordings of the interviews. And finally, if you are part of an organization that is aware of the disruptive and transformational impact that emerging and future technologies will bring and want to know more, please get in touch to hear about the strategic foresight services that we offer and how we can help future-proof your organization and take advantage of the phenomenal opportunities available to survive and thrive in the future.
A lot of future shock people and future shock institutions in our society are simply overwhelmed.
Once there is superintelligence, the fate of humanity may depend on what the superintelligence does.
Science fact is catching up to science fiction.
The first truly intelligent machine will be the last invention that humanity needs to make.
The only scarcity that will exist in the future is that which we decide to create ourselves as humans.
Within a 10-year design revolution, we can have all humanity living the highest and living anybody's ever known.
Progress is accelerating at an exponential pace, and it's going to reach a point where progress is so fast, it's going to be a singularity.
We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens.
Every single headline points to the birth pangs of a Type 1 civilization.